What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Orale Ball Heights, coming at you from Espacio 1839. I'm here with my guest, Mariah Castañeda, after a false start. I'm trying to get this show started. But thank you again, Mariah, for coming through today.
Thanks so much for having me. I am so excited to be here.
Yeah, so let's get into that. Why, aside from wanting to talk to you and getting to know you a little bit, you are here promoting a show. What is the name of the show?
The show is called The Sellout.
And what is The Sellout about?
The Sellout is about Jose Huizar, and it's basically about a guy who became a city council member here in Los Angeles. He represented Boyle Heights. He represented District 14, which includes Highland Park, Eagle Rock, El Sereno.
Boyle Heights.
In Boyle Heights.
Yep. CD 14. There you go. So, yeah, I got to preview two episodes of the show. They're still making some minor tweaks, but I was able to get the full gist of it. And y'all are in for a treat. This is super well-produced. Neon Home Media collaboration with LA Taco. Mariah is the host. And throughout I don't know. Do you know how many episodes are going to be?
It'll be 9 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah, whole thing.
That's 9 episodes. You already, from the first 2 episodes, you already introduced a handful of folks already that you interviewed. So definitely a lot of different perspectives, a lot of different angles of how this conversation is going to move through. But we'll get into that right now with talking a little bit more about you, Mariah, getting to know you as a person, since you're here, since most of the show is going to be dedicated to talking about The Sellout.
Yeah.
So we can start with, like, you can let folks know where you grew up.
Where I grew up? So I grew up in a number of places. When I was, like, little, I lived in the Inland Empire, you know, Adelanto, Victorville, Hesperia, that's where I lived. And then I lived in the San Gabriel Valley for a little bit. And then when I was, like, 13, like, in the 8th grade, I moved to Sella and Huntington Park and Southgate area. And I really fell in love with Sella. It was the first place where I felt a sense of, like, community. I felt like whatever I needed, like, there's always neighbors to help me, friends to help me. I felt a lot of love there. So I really fell in love with the area. And I think that's where a lot of my passion comes from.
Nice. Can you share a little bit of why y'all had to move so much?
Yeah, so things weren't really, like, super stable. So I lived with, like, a couple different family members, you know, things really weren't stable at home too much. So for me, that's kind of why, in a nutshell, it's kind of why we moved so much. And I think that's kind of why I fell in love with Sella so much, because in Sella, I think there's a lot of, like, community kind of, like, there's just a lot of community everywhere. And it's, like, there's a lot of love. It may not be, like, it might be kind of rough sometimes, but I love how the community is. Like, people are the kindest there. People are so nice. People are so, like, there for one another. Like,
yeah.
You'll never go home hungry over there.
That's awesome. I love how you say that. It can be rough, but there's a lot of love.
Yeah.
That's the side of, like, a true community. Like, and very much I share that with, like, the way Boyle Heights is. This, despite, as I'm getting older and me getting super annoyed with hood shit. Like, why do we have to live like this? Like, not, and this is beyond the stuff that's, like, out of our control, like police, you know, helicopters buzzing our neighborhoods and other systemic things like that. It's, like, the stuff of, like, why are you trying to have a party on Monday till midnight? Bro, like, come on. I mean, I don't know what your job is, but my job is not, like, letting me stay up till midnight on a Monday. do you have some favorite spots in Sella that you can, like, shout out to folks?
Sella, okay, let me think. Really like El Solito. That's a newer, like, place. Opened up in 2016. I love how Danny kind of made it into, like, a community kind of, like, spot. So there's, like, open mics from, like, local elementary school. There's, like, fundraisers. Every time there's, like, an earthquake in, like, Mexico or something like that, he'll, like, have a fundraiser.
Speaking of, there was one this morning.
No, there was? Okay, yeah. I used to go there all the time. When I lived on Huntington Park, I used to walk there almost every day because I would, like, do my homework there. I would do, like, some of my, like, taco stuff there.
Nice.
And then, you know, I think
it's changed a lot since, like, over the years with, like, more. I mean, we've had conversations about this over, like, since we've known each other, about how Pacific Boulevard is changing for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, a lot of my favorite spot is no longer there. There's this Pupusa spot on Pacific Street, and I went back and it was gone, and I was really sad. I don't even remember the name. I used to go there, like, a lot when I was, like, like throughout college, you know.
Affordable, good eats. Yeah,
and it looked nice. Like I could like spend $5 on a pupusa and it'd be this giant pupusa and then I could be full and I could sit in this nice little area. I felt like bougie even though like, you know, it wasn't very much.
Yeah, I think I've been spending more time in Sela now more than ever, especially just eating my way through it. Mm-hmm. And, like, always checking out what's happening. Crucitas is one of my favorite spots to go to in Huntington Park. Mm-hmm. You know, get some coffee, get a nice sandwich, get some pastries. Definitely a lot of chill vibes there. But, you know, always, like, if folks have any recommendations for Sela, hit me up. I'm always looking for new places to try. So you grew up moving around and you kind of settled on Sela. How did you get started in your journalism career?
So actually, oh my God, I don't want to get emotional. So actually, my grandpa got me into journalism. Hey. So living in Adelanto and, you know, you're kind of in the middle of nowhere. And we lived, like, he actually was here in L.A. first. But, you know, just it's more affordable over there. Mm-hmm. So when I lived with him, he would always say, like, oh, mija, you want to read this newspaper to me? And it'd be the L.A. Times. And he'd sit me on his knee and he'd always be like, mija, you know, like, my English isn't very good. You want to read this to me? Of course, his English is amazing because he bought the paper and everything. But he would want to trick me into reading the entire thing to him. And so I'd be like, oh, yeah, like, I'll be helpful. And for me, like, we lived literally before Adelanto had, like, more stuff. And I'm sure you probably know of it because of the horrible prison over there.
Mm, private, like, immigration prisons, yeah.
Yeah, but what people don't know is that there's actually a huge, like, immigrant community. There's a huge Mexican community there. A lot of people that couldn't, you know, afford rent over here move over there. And, you know, like, you go to my grandpa's house now, there'll be corridos playing in the background. People will just, like, you know, it's really, 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 like, a big immigrant community.
Yeah, life happening.
Yeah, it's fun. But anyways, over there, it was, like, just desert. Like, back then, it was, like, our house and then two houses down, and then it was just nothing but desert.
Wow, that's pretty isolated. That's pretty extreme, too, having to deal with that kind of weather, dust, when the winds picks up, and, like, it's pretty harsh.
It was really funny, though, because, like, I remember my first dust storm, and when I was a kid, it was, like, a dust storm. Like, oh, a dust storm's going to happen. So imagine this intergenerational, like, you know, family. And, you know, me and my parents, like, we're not from the desert. My grandpa's kind of new there, too. So we're all just trying to figure out how to prepare the house for a dust storm.
Close the windows, you know, close the shades. I wouldn't know how to do that either. Like, I would probably have to look it up on the internet and be like, all right, this is what I need to do. And then come, like, after the dust storm, probably figure out that I forgot something. And then there's a bunch of sand in there. I don't know.
Yeah, there's like tumbleweeds. It's like a whole different thing, but it still has some LA vibes. A lot of LA people move over there.
Yeah. It's unfortunately happening a lot more and more with everybody getting pushed out. Mm-hmm. But you were reading to your grandpa, and then how did it become like something you were like, this is what I want to do in school?
Well, I think like it kind of stayed in my mind all those years. Like, wow, I want to write too. I want to be a writer. And, you know, I'm writerly. Oh, and then my cousin who just dropped me off also got me into writing. She's like, oh, you should write. You know, I like to write when I was, like, a little kid. And I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to write and be, like, a writer. And, you know, but when I was, like, going through school, my parents really wanted me to do something like, you know, being a doctor, a lawyer, that thing.
Yeah, high aspirations.
High aspirations. They're like, you know, you're not going to make no money being a writer. And I'm like, okay. So I got into college, you know, some things happened, and I was like, I went to college to be a doctor, right? I was in the whole pre-med, I was in, like, a bio, I was [S2] Wow. [S1] Like, okay, I'm doing pre-med, everything. Hated it, and I took, like, journalism kind of as a side class just to kind of, you know, get into it, and I fell in love with it, and I just, yeah, I did that, and I started writing, and I just started trying to pitch as much as I could.
Where were you going to school for journalism?
I went to UC Irvine.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Right, so you kind of did like the routine most of us do. Is you take a class, you know, you end up falling in love with it, and then you join the newspaper staff?
I didn't have too much time to be the staff because I did work a lot, but I could do like, I would try to write as much as I could.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, try to flex those muscles. Mm-hmm. With you, you know, going through that in school, did you feel you still need to continue your schooling, like maybe go into like master's or do other programs, or were you like, did you feel ready like once you were done with school, like I can do this and start freelancing on my own?
I didn't feel ready. However, I didn't think journalism would ever pay me enough to be, to, like, I didn't feel like journalism would ever pay me enough to make getting a master's worth it. Mm. And I didn't think it was fair that you, people basically go get their master's just so they can network and not really much else. That might be a little controversial. Oops. I
think people with master's will agree with you.
Like, come on. I'm not going to go get my master's so I can hang out with people.
Yeah, it's a whole other... academia is really intense, and that's not my lane. I respect people for it. I have high admiration of those folks that can go on and do that and even continue doing that to the level of, like, PhD or, like, multiple degrees, right? And, you know, then they become the folks that are writing books and putting out all these, like, leading articles and research and things like that. But that's not me.
Yeah.
I can't live that life.
I mean, I agree with that. I really respect folks that can make it through academia. You know, my partner is an academic, and I really appreciate that, and I respect that kind of lifestyle. However, I do think our industry has too many people that are very educated, like, have high degrees and stuff like that, and I don't feel like our industry pays enough for that, and I think we need to have more folks that, you know, maybe weren't able to do that kind
of
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of issues with access, for sure. So, you know, you, what were some of the early publications you started working at, or how, well, let me circle back. Since you didn't feel it was worth it to continue on in higher education, where did you move on to next?
So I moved on to, I tried writing for the California Health Report. I wrote for the Voice of OC for a while because I was in Orange County, which was different.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I literally 2 years, and then I was, like, doing the whole thing where I was, like, commuting from Huntington Park to UC Irvine, and I was, like, still reporting over there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, just there. I did Fusion for a little bit.
Fusion isn't around anymore, is it?
They became Splinter, and I don't know what happened to Splinter.
So, share with folks what Fusion used to be.
So Fusion was like a news site, and it was like progressive, I guess, but it was kind of had like a weird identity crisis. So basically, first it was owned by ABC and Disney, but then Univision bought it out, and it was like, okay, this is going to be like our English media. But then it was also kind of like, but they also like co-owned it with like, or they owned it with like the Gawker media stuff, so it was like a whole thing.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like all these little sites, and then there's one parent umbrella company.
Yeah.
So you were doing work here and there. I think at one point you were at UNVCN, right?
Well, through Fusion.
Yeah. How was that experience?
Oh, it was different. So it was like a fellowship, and it was for folks that maybe had like a different background in journalism. Because, you know, journalism, I think, you know, some folks might need like some support, you know. So the whole thing was like, we are a paid fellowship. And it was great. I loved it. I learned a lot. I'm so grateful for the experience I had there. I made a lot of friends. Got to do a lot of cool stories.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you got paid.
And I got paid.
Which is so rare.
Which back then was not a thing.
No. So we can skip ahead a little bit. How did you end up working with LA Taco?
So it's really funny. So one day I was following Daniel on Twitter, and I saw him, our former editor-in-chief, and he tweeted something about, like, needing more women to go, I guess, pitch stories to him at LA Taco. So then I was like, hey, what up? I'm a woman, and I want to pitch stories. And I tweeted at him. And he was like, cool, here's my email. So I emailed him, and I was like, hey, I tweeted at you.
Nice. What, do you remember what were some of those early stories you pitched and you maybe got followed up through and got published?
So basically, it actually turned into like a whole social media thing. He was like, "Can you be a social media manager?" And I did that with you for a while.
Yeah.
And then my first assignment was like where to buy all things Dodgers blue when they made it to the World Series in, I think, like 2018.
The listicle of like, hey, everybody's making blue colored foods from donuts to like horchatas, like, and it's pretty fun to kind of put out that content.
Yeah.
That's cool. How did you? Like balancing that role, because being a social media manager isn't being a writer, but I know you were able to do both too. How were you able to balance?
Well, I've been doing both for a while now, but I think it's because it's like, so my first journalism job at Voice of OC, I actually was a social media manager. I was a social media intern. I wasn't very good at it. So I was like, and people complained about the social media intern, like that was me. No, I'm just kidding.
What did they say? Like, you weren't tweeting their articles?
I was tweeting it. I just felt like my tweets weren't really snappy. They weren't really good. It was just like, hey, this thing happened. Read about it.
Yeah, that sounds more like a personal thing. Like, you don't like the way I write it, then you write it.
Well, I don't think they had a problem with that. I just personally had a problem with it looking back. Does that make sense? Okay. Like, I'm a much better social media person now than I was back then. Because back then it was like 2015. It was new for me. I was an intern running their social media accounts, which does not happen.
That is a world of difference in terms of like social media. Jesus.
Yeah. So nowadays it's like you never have the intern touch the socials.
Well, no.
Yeah.
No. And then when something bad happens, then you blame the intern.
Yeah. But sorry, totally distracted from the point. So basically, it was a little different. I think in social media, you have to be really snappy. You have to do everything really quick. I think it did help me as a writer, but I feel like all my sentences now when I write kind of look like tweets sometimes.
It's just short and snappy comebacks like every other sentence. I feel that. I feel how that will influence like a lot of your writing and how you process things. Are there some stories that you're really like, yeah, I wrote that, like for LA Taco, like that you're proud of?
Yeah, there was a couple stories that I'm glad I wrote. There was a story about, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank. I'm trying to think. There was one about some like fire that went through a power plant. I'm really happy I wrote about. There's another one about like.
Oh, that's right. So it was which is something that's becoming more and more of a real problem. But most of us are used to it because it happens regularly. It's like fire season. Mm-hmm. And that it was, these fires just go uncontrolled and the spread. And sometimes it depends on how they start too. But this one was, it was the fire was getting close to like radioactive hazard waste or a site, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember. And then the other story I did about data surveillance from the police. So basically the police, they like have all these cameras and they take pictures of license plates, mm-hmm. and they track you. And then they share that information across the United States, which was like mind blowing to me. And I was like, oh my God, this is so scary.
It's still going on.
Yeah, it's still going on. The other story that's really sad and I'm happy I broke it. And I'm glad I did. But I don't like it. It's a story about how the way the police treated women and non-binary people of color too during the George Floyd uprisings, mm-hmm. and how they treated them when they arrested them. And it was a horrific story, but I'm very proud that LA Taco chose to go with that story, and I'm very happy that I got the support I needed from the staff here to report on it, because it was a story that needed to be done. And I feel like I just didn't like the way it was being talked about at the moment. Like, I feel like a lot of newsrooms were relying on the police.
What was being given to them.
The police, like, oh, well, she said this, but then the police said that. And I'm like, what if we do it in a way where I can find different women in the same bus and they can all corroborate each other's stories so I don't have to rely on the police report?
Yeah.
Like, duh.
It's obviously a different, highlighting a different voice is more. Most mainstream news channels will just treat it as straight news, right? Mm-hmm. And don't really try to go beyond that. But that's where your story comes in. You're talking to folks that were there, that this was their experience, and you were centering them before like police reports or any other like information that was coming out. So yeah, that was a really powerful story. I can't think of it right now, but I don't think you've written anything lately for Taco, huh?
Not in a while, because I've been focusing on this show. Like, that's all I've been doing.
Yeah, I can imagine.
There was one story. Oh, wait, no, I didn't actually finish it. Never mind.
But we can go into that. So we mentioned the show, The Sellout. It's a collaboration with Neon Hum Media and LA Taco. But can you share, how did this collaboration kind of get started?
So the CEO, Jonathan, got into my DMs and he's like, hey, we want to collaborate with the LA Taco on this show about Jose Wisad. I'm like, cool, awesome. And I hit you up, Eric. I was like, you want to work on this? And you're like, no.
I think I said, yeah. I would like listen to the meeting, to like the initial meetings of like, yeah. You know, them like doing the spiel and like sharing what the ideas were. And I remember this was at the end of the year, and I was transitioning jobs. So as soon as I got the new job where I'm at now, I was like, I'm going to have to peace out because my full attention is going to be directly just focused on that. And I was like, all right, I'll let y'all handle it. And, you know, I don't think y'all lost anything with me not being there. Y'all did an amazing job. There's an amazing production team and a lot of great interviews with a lot of community members and a lot of politicians and folks that contribute to the story that paints a very larger picture that isn't just about Wisar and his political career and what he did right and wrong. It also paints a bigger picture of the city within, like, the last couple of years, honestly, between the first conversations that I've heard, of how much things are changing, shifting dynamics in politics, and a lot of key events that, unless you live in the neighborhood or you were following that kind of news, you might have forgot about them already. Yeah. So y'all did an amazing job with, like, bringing up so many different angles and perspectives and lifting up a lot of voices. How did, aside from, like, that initial, like, DM message and you know, y'all talking about it, did you, like, think about it or, like, have hesitations, or were you just, like, all in as soon as you heard it?
Dang. Wait, 1 second, though. I do want to say I appreciate you so much for being in the show. I know how busy you were, and I was totally joking earlier. Like, I appreciate you giving us time to be interviewed, meeting up with us. Like, it's, like, your voice in the show, especially in the first episode. I mean, and all episodes you come out and it's good, but I'm so grateful to have you in the first episode, especially. I'm like, hey, it's my homie.
Yeah. You had Nancy, you had a couple of other folks. And I also would like to go on the record and correct myself that once you hear this, a little spoiler warning, you will hear me call the kiosco a gazebo, yeah. Which is not right. So, you know, tune that out when you hear me.
I mean, it's horrible because it's like, I mean, I am English dominant, so you're like, you know, I don't know how you felt, but, like, I feel like some folks maybe didn't. We were kind of, like, going back and forth. Like, some folks were like, kiosco, gazebo, and I'm like,
I wasn't even thinking about it. We were interviewing.
Oh, okay.
I was, like, thinking about that food we were eating.
That was really good food.
Yeah, we were eating from tacos from Santa Cecilia, which they were super awesome. They were generous. We agreed to, like, hey, can we meet up here at this time, at this place, to, you know, talk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, y'all came through, you had your equipment, we started talking, and they just came up to us, it's like, hey, would you like some tacos while you're here? And they're like, yeah.
Oh, my God. And then we recorded it, and it was so good.
Tacos de tripa and pork rib tacos and a salsa roja. It was. I'm getting hungry now. And I'm getting off track.
after this, we're going to get some.
Yeah, but were you all in as soon as you heard the pitch? Or, like, did you have to think about it?
I thought about it. I wanted to do it because it sounded, like, interesting. And sometimes I'll be so interested in something. Like, I was nervous as hell about it. I was so nervous. I had so much anxiety. It's something that gave me anxiety for almost a year. But also, when a story hooks you and grabs you, you just kind of go for it, for me at least. And it just kind of goes beyond all the other, like, apprehensions I felt. But it was a little daunting at first. But just having, like, Lex there, having Carla, and then just feeling it's, like, the three of us, and then our amazing editors, Catherine and Vikram, and then obviously Liz, too. Like, all of us together, I feel like we made a really cohesive team. And I think we all added something that, you know, can help make it the way it is. For me, at least, I knew it was going to be a true crime podcast, but, okay, I hate true crime so much, and I know I'm the host of a true crime show. I hate true crime. It's funny, but I hate it. Sorry, I said it too many times. But, so I was like, you know what? What if we focus on what this guy did? Let's focus on the community. Let's focus on how they fought back.
Shifted around, yeah.
Exactly.
Hell yeah. But speaking of, how did you feel I don't know how that came to be, but how do you feel being the host of the show?
Okay, so when Jonathan asked me to be the host, they were like, okay, Mariah, there's a meeting between you and Jonathan. I never have meetings with Jonathan. He's the CEO of Neon Hum. So a meeting between my producer, Carlo, was like, there's a meeting with you, me, and Jonathan. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, man, what did I do?
What did I say? Did I tweet something wrong?
What did I do? So I go to this meeting over Zoom. I'm like, man, what's going to happen? They're like, it's going to be good. Don't worry. So then Jonathan is like, hey, do you want to be the host? I trust you with the story. And I'm like, I don't know, because I don't really like the limelight like that.
You're, like, pretty front and center. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, but then I kind of thought about it. I'm like, okay, who else could be the host, though? And there could be a lot of people, you know, a lot of people would have made a good host. But the thing is that, like, they didn't work on it the way all of us did. And I was thinking, like, well, you know, I eventually agreed, But I was like, there were a couple times in the first month I was like, this is kind of scary. Maybe not.
It is. Would this be, it's safe to say this is like your first time doing something like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I do like the LA Taco podcast, but it's not the same level.
I didn't think we had that pressure on each other to be like, you know, like we got to get this right. It was like, nah, let's just riff and like go with it.
Yeah. Like, no, when you're a host, it's like, you got to rep the work. You got to rep it. You got to be like, like, you know, between us, obviously people listening to this, you know, I get really nervous. I am an anxious person. You know this, worth that. I don't hide it. But, like, when you're a host, you're like, yeah, I got this all figured out. This is my show. I am so proud. And you got to, like, rep it. And you can't show any fear.
Yeah, most definitely. So you did a great job. As much as, you know, we all like to critique ourselves and kind of fall into that negative thinking behind our minds of, like, you know, touching on that imposter syndrome and stuff like that. You pulled it off. You did an amazing job.
Thank you. So, oh my God. Thanks.
You know, now you know that you have this in you, and should another opportunity come up, you could totally go for it. And why is my microphone making all these crinkly noise? Como chingan. If it's not one thing or it's another, we're just going to have to talk really loud.
Oh, okay. Right there, stop.
So a couple of other observations I made from the show, from the first two episodes, is y'all are, like I was saying, y'all go into a lot of different spaces. And in going into those spaces, y'all also start flushing out conversations through events and happenings, flags that were like coming up. Whereas like the the current social media meme is all those little red flag emojis, right? So all these red flags started popping up as Weezar was just going about his life and doing things here and there, you know, crashing into cars, cheating on his wife and stuff like that. And some of the other points that also happened simultaneously are really crucial to what's been going on in the neighborhood, in Bull Heights specifically, the last couple of years, with like one of them being the creation and formation of Defend Bull Heights.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So how did y'all get that conversation with Nancy going?
So Javier is good friends with her. So I was like, so it took a while to get to talk to her. It took a while, like, reaching out, coordinating. But we finally got to talk to Nancy through Javier. That's actually how that conversation started. I am so shocked that Nancy gave us the time of day, because I followed Nancy's work for a while, you know, and I think she's a really powerful, I think Nancy's a really powerful person, and, you know, I respect that, and Nancy is a really, I don't know, like, Nancy is like, a, I don't know how to explain it, Nancy is brilliant, and anytime Nancy talked to us, if I felt like, wow, I get this lecture for free. Like, this is, like, amazing. And I felt like, dang, like, anytime I interviewed Nancy, I felt like I had all this, like, it just, everything makes so much sense. And it's, like, I get to kind of experience this brilliance. And it felt like such an honor and such a privilege. And I am so grateful that Nancy gave us all that time and, like, became, actually, Nancy is a huge voice in our show. Like, you will hear Nancy on the show, and I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah, they're an amazing person, which also, like, brings me to my next question, which is, how did you feel having to, well, not having to, but, you know, having done a lot of these interviews with a lot of folks, with myself, from the episodes that I've heard with Elizabeth Blaney of, you know, Nevecinos, Mariachi, that was also interviewed for the story, and I'm assuming for the rest of the 9 episodes, you also talked to a bunch of different other folks. How did you, like, kind of absorb that of, like, you're interviewing all these different folks for the work, but I can kind of see from behind the scenes that as you're talking to everybody, you're putting this, like, larger vision, this jigsaw puzzle together. So how was it, like, interviewing everybody from, like, different perspectives?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. It's really important to get multiple perspectives, because it's like, you want to have someone like Nancy, right? Nancy saw it from the beginning. Nancy, like, knew. And I think that's something I really valued. But also, I wanted to get people that were willing to be vulnerable and willing to say that they really liked the guy, right? So we have people like Raquel, who was actually heartbroken.
Yeah, Raquel Zamora, yeah.
Yeah. And she was heartbroken when she saw the whole FBI thing happen. And, you know, there's someone like Norbs who, like, saw, you know, we saw it as, like, you know, he said that he thought at one point he was going to be, like, the first Mexican president. And
right? Big ambitions there.
Yeah. Or something like that. And I'm really grateful for folks that are willing to say that they saw a lot of, you know, what's it called? Potential in him.
I mean, they weren't the only ones. I think we all need to embrace that and figure it out for ourselves in one way or another, no matter how we feel about politics and politicians, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I won't lie. I won't fake the funk that at one point I was like, that's Jose Huizar. He's the council member. He knows me. And I think I mentioned this in some of the interviews. I don't know if it made it through, but from my experiences with Huizar over the years, it was like there was a point of, like, in the beginning, I was like, oh, that's Huizar, and he knows my name. He knows who I am. He wants to talk to me, right? He recognizes me. When I see him at events, he'll, like, make his way through me, like, to me and say hi. And it was like if I was, like, with the person I was dating or with friends, I was like, oh, wow. Ooh, you know Huizar like that, right? And then as like things started to change and his perception and his, like, you know, actions started speaking more for themselves, it started to become like, oh man, I gotta, like, hide my face. There's Huizar. I don't want him to see me because I don't want him to say hi to me.
It's like, don't worry, I'm not like that. I promise.
But I honestly didn't think about it until, like, we started talking for the show, and I realized that it's like, yeah, it was a progression of like, oh yeah, cool, there's Huizar, let me go say hi. I was like, oh shit, there's Huizar, you know, let me get away and go to the bathroom or something.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting because it's like, it was really hard to find people that were like, hey, I used to like Huizar and now I don't. Mm-hmm. Like, people hate to admit that they're wrong, and to imagine how hard it is to admit you were wrong, and to come out on a podcast and be like, hey, what up, I was wrong.
That's basically my show.
Yeah, and that's why I'm so grateful for the folks that came on were like, hey, I was wrong. That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
And then, like, the mariachis, of course, when they came out, and I think for them, what I really valued from them was how much they were really vulnerable. Like, what they did came at a cost. And I think they were really vulnerable with us. So I think, like, you know, I think at the time in 2017, when we saw all this stuff go down, they were seen as, like, an icon of resistance, right? Like, wow, look, it was, like, inspiration.
It's a rent strike.
It's a rent strike. The thing is that beyond the cameras and beyond all these other things, like, the mariachis had to go deal with this on their own. They had to go. This was a really scary decision for them. This was a really exhausting decision for them. This is something that made them really tired, and they had their full time jobs on top of, like, fighting for this, for their homes. Which, by the way, they reached a deal with their landlord, but that deal actually expires either this year or next year.
Yeah.
So it's exhausting for them, and I think, like, people see it as inspiration, but these mariachis, they were just fighting for their homes, and they don't exist as your inspiration porn. They don't exist to inspire you.
To, like, be fetishized, yeah.
Exactly. They are simply just trying to fight for their homes, and I did want to show that, and I wanted to show that they were people that were fighting to be in their homes, and they have backstories, and they have these families, and they have a whole thing, and I wanted to kind of go beyond the icon. So, like, you can hear the story of, like, you know, and then putting on, like, the mariachi suit for the first time. Like, I had to include that in.
That was awesome. Yeah. That's what I'm really digging about, like, from the first episodes, that y'all are, you know, really getting in there with folks and not pushing them, but allowing them that space to be vulnerable, right? That if they feel they're comfortable, that they can go there, they can. And if they don't, they don't have to. Because I think that's a big difference, too. It's a lot more genuine to get those stories from folks.
Yeah, and I get it. Because someone above the editor, wanted me to share a personal story about myself. Mm. And I didn't want to. I'm like, that's my trauma. And I'm not going to be sharing my trauma with anybody like that. Like, not for this show, not for anybody. And it made me think, like, okay, people can share what they want, but they don't have to share everything.
Yeah.
Because in this show, I have to include a little piece of myself, and I don't want to. I wanted to keep myself completely separate from this show because I just want to be here and present it. And, like, I think a lot of times in media, they make you feel like you have to share your personal, like, darkest, deepest secrets sometimes in order for you to get the clicks, in order for you to get the, you know. And I don't want to do that. Like, my trauma is for me. And it's because, you know, basically, you know, Exide.
Yep.
They wanted me to share how I was affected by it a little bit. So I only kept it to a sentence, and I try to keep it very, like, just enough.
Yeah. Yeah. No need to feel pressured. You shouldn't have to feel pressured to do that. So definitely glad, you know, you're like, here, nah, I'm good.
Yeah, but, like, at the same time, as a creator now, I don't want to be pushing people that much. Yeah. Like,
you know how that feels. It's not comfortable feeling to be in, to be like, but tell me how you really feel. How sad are you? You know, like, how violent was that crime or what happened? So I definitely feel you on that. I'm never trying to push people to go into those spaces unless they feel comfortable sharing on their own terms. But, yeah, so 9 episodes long. Not to, like, spoil anything, and you don't have to spoil anything either, but from what I've heard, I can assume, and you know what happens when you assume, that a lot of it is like, kind of based chronological, like, on a timeline. So if you've followed Weezer's career and, like, some of his big moments, then you kind of already kind of know where the show's going to be going, no? Is that safe to say?
Yeah, but then we actually go past. The story goes past where you might think it might end. Because I think essentially CD14 was left without a lot of representation, was left without representation. I mean, before the whole, you know, FBI raid, but also, you know, after. And then also during the global pandemic where people were losing their loved ones, people were losing their jobs, and there was literally a lack of, like, political representation during the worst possible time because this man had to be corrupt.
And, I mean, it's funny you say that because we're kind of in that situation again where Kevin De Leon says he wants to, you know, walk his way over to City Hall and say, I want to be mayor.
So this is a really funny story where LA Taco, I profiled Raquel Zamora.
Yeah.
And she talked about, like, Kevin De Leon, she said something about him just wanting to use that stepping stone to be mayor. So I published that, and then his publicist came into my DMs and was like, meh, I want to respond. And I was like, I just, like, left him on read.
Good, because that's what happened. That's what they did.
You know what? I should have let him respond, and that was my bad, and I regret it, and I was wrong.
But at the moment, you're like, why am I going to waste my time, like, with these folks? You got other things to do. You got your life to live. Fuck that.
This is true. This is true.
You don't need to be giving people space, but... This happened during the last election for CD14. And, yeah, I mean, Raquel, a lot of other people who follow LA politics closely, they kind of saw this, like, CD14 has been one of those districts where that's been a track record for a lot of people to get in here and then jump off and go do something else. Villagarosa did that. If he could, Weezer probably would have done the same thing, you know? And I think De Leon is just using the community. When he got elected, we had, like, a campaign fund of, like, a couple of $1 million, which was, like, ridiculous compared to other folks, like, especially somebody like Raquel, who was, like, super grassroots and just, like, door knocking and, like, really getting the support of, like, close friends and neighbors and business connections. And now this who just wants to leave the community out, not just Boyle Heights, Sereno, all the other spaces in CD14, because he just wants to continue furthering his career. So for me, I'm like, really, foo? Like, now that Karen Bass, like, said they're running, I don't think you have a chance. Like,
yeah, no, he should just stay and, like, do what he's supposed to do. But let me tell you, when I was requesting records from him, it was an experience.
Really, I can imagine. I mean, I don't want that situation to happen where, like, you tried running for mayor, you didn't get it, and now you're, like, stanky ass has to be here begrudgingly doing your job. It's like, then why did you even run for office in the first place if you're not into it? So I get frustrated with that because, like, everybody else in their neighborhood, right, we see so many things going on that we know can be fixed, that can be addressed. You know, some things obviously require more effort than others, but if the local politician is paying attention to what's happening in the different communities, then those things wouldn't get to a point where, like, it gets serious or like it gets out of hand or like folks just get so mad that they have to go to their house mm-hmm. and like protest them or something, right? Or keep calling them out on social media. So, and then on top of that too, more chisme with like Mark Ridley Thomas catching a case.
Oh man, I read that indictment. That was rough.
I had to read a couple of different news articles just to get a better sense of like what was really going on. And I mean, it's with like the podcast with De Leon, now with Mark Ridley Thomas. It's like, and then a couple of other folks también who got busted as same, you know. I don't think that there's much, like, aspiration or faith in our politicians.
Yeah, I agree. I think what's interesting, though, about Jose Wizard and Mark Ridley Thompson was that he did... It was, like, sexual assault or sexual harassment that led to the downfall of both. I mean, so MRT, like, it's not the same at all because it's actually a relative, according to indictment.
Mm-hmm. Allegedly.
Allegedly. Sprinkle that everywhere. Had like a sexual harassment issue. And he was afraid of getting called out. And so his dad was like, or his relative, the councilman was like, okay, well, not the councilman then, a supervisor then, was like, okay, yeah, you know, try to set up a deal with him at USC.
Yeah.
So he could be a professor, student, and like getting some like $25,000 stipend. There was like the Department of Child Services involved, contracts, all this kind of mess. And then with Jose Wizard, it's the whole thing where it's like, what happened?
He got caught in Vegas, like, taking money.
Well, not just that, though. No, the sexual harassment part. So he was...
Oh, that's right.
So he got in trouble for... There was a lawsuit against him. He needed... By Francine Godoy. And he
basically... His former staffer. Yeah.
And he basically needed $500,000 to go make it all go away. And... so where do you get that money from?
This sounds allegedly. This sounds like the plot to Training Day.
Yeah. Where do you get the money from? He got it from developers. So the moral of the story is if you treat people right, you don't sexually harass people, you probably won't be able to be corrupted as easily. And if you don't try to stick up for family members that have sexually harassed people and try to get them to like not pay the not face the consequences, you'll be fine. Like none of this had to happen. All this is very unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for like the councilman Jose Wizard, I feel like in his case, I feel like that's what opened the floodgates for him. It was like, okay, I did this one thing that worked. Now I can do all these other things.
I definitely feel that. One thing I also started noticing, especially, like, obviously in the last year because things have been so intense in so many different ways, is more community-based groups, right? Not so much tied to a nonprofit, just folks genuinely getting together and, like, deciding, like, we're going to fight for something and try to change something. Folks like People City Council, K-Town for All, really holding folks, especially politicians, feet to the fire and trying to get them accountable to, like, what they might have promised because they were running for office or things they've said, and even starting to change the landscape a little bit. Do you think that's where we need to kind of shift our attention to, where, like, more younger folks are doing this and doing more of this grassroots work?
Yeah, I think we need to kind of shift our focus there. I think, well, you know, maybe I'm not the most... maybe I'm not the right person to be saying either, but I think we need to be focusing on what the young folks are doing, young folks that are holding like local elected officials' feet to the fire.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be focusing on them. I also think we need to focus on people that have been like calling out City Hall for a long time. A lot of people have been like, you know, in the game for a while. And I think, you know, we need to respect those folks too. I think what I've learned is that it's a whole ecosystem of people that have been filling in the gaps of the lack of leadership in this. Well, the lack of competent leadership in the city. So I feel like, you know, there's people that are setting up food pantries. There are people that are... I feel like it's like a whole ecosystem, right? It's a whole group of people that are trying to basically fill in all the needs. And there are a lot of needs because city council or elected officials don't really put, I think, the folks' needs first. So there's like... people, like one person in the podcast, she's doing like a food pantry and meeting the needs of people in El Sereno that, you know, are struggling with food insecurity.
Yeah.
There are people that are really into educating their communities on what's happening in local city politics because most of us are too busy to be tuning into every single city hall meeting, right? And that's people like the People City Council, like there's like LA Pod, all these great folks. And there's other people that are actually putting, like, you know, their bodies on the line and, like, out there protesting mm-hmm. when city council tries to do something stupid. Like, there are policies that are very anti-unhoused folks. And then there's other people that, you know, are trying to... I'm trying to think of, like, I feel like I'm missing something.
We always do.
Yeah.
Because there's so many amazing folks doing so much great work.
Yeah. So it really takes an entire ecosystem of people to really fill in those gaps to fight against city council. Not fight, but, like, you know, hold them accountable.
Hold them accountable. And sometimes fight with them, yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard because it's, like, people... Like, what Nancy said in our last interview is that people are so tired because our rents are so high. If we didn't have to pay half of our paychecks for rent, most of us, or more, if we didn't have all this, like, housing insecurity, we could be so much more powerful. Imagine if you only had to pay a little bit of rent. Maybe it was only, like, a quarter of your paycheck mm-hmm. or, like, I don't know, an eighth of your paycheck or something like that. Imagine, like... not that much, you would have so much more time to go out and hold your city council accountable. You'd have so much more time to invest in your community, to hang out, to, like, help, you know, other people out, basically. But instead, we're here working, like, two or three jobs trying to pay our rent.
Yeah. The whole thing of, like, having a side hustle and, like, being so common.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely feel that. And I definitely feel that exhaustion, too, of, like, you... We spend so much time just trying to survive and get by that, yeah, why would we want to spend the other little free time that we have, you know, trying to argue or fight with people when we can just be spending that time to be, you know, with ourselves, with loved ones, with friends, like sharing space with folks we want to be with, eating, hanging out, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it can get exhausting. And there's nonprofits, there's other CBOs. Like, you perfectly summed it up. It's an ecosystem, right? Everybody plays their part. But the fact that more, especially in the last year, more and more community-based groups have to form and fill in where the government, our elected officials, like, you know, nonprofits have been failing us, really says a lot about where, like, things are going.
For sure. And it's kind of like, okay, y'all are getting paid like money to handle all these things and like people that aren't getting paid are filling in the gaps.
Yeah. Like when Ciclovia was here a couple of weeks ago, the Leon had a booth and they were just giving out hand sanitizers, tote bags, face mask and a couple of things, which I appreciate because I took one of those boxes of masks home. I was like, oh, cool. These are really good masks. These are like K95. Like, mm-hmm. This is the good stuff. So that kind of stuff is just so superfluous because, you know, are you just going to set up in a booth at an event and that's it? Like, that's your claim to, like, I helped the community today. I was like, that's whack. That's not enough. So we got to keep holding them accountable, folks. And I think as one experience that I shared with the interview that we did was how shaming them on social media also worked.
Yeah, it does. They really care. What else? Yeah, what was I going to say? I don't remember.
It's fine. So I wanted to circle back a little bit to the show since we got a little distracted with the politics conversation. Well, you already mentioned some of the amazing folks that helped put this team together and put this show together. I know the music played a big part in this. How did that come about?
Yeah, so I like, oh my God, I cannot believe we got the music the way it was. Wow. Okay, so we got it with Eduardo Arenas from Chicano Batman, the bassist. Yeah. And it was actually one of, you know, Eric Galindo from, you know, I mean, he helped us make that happen. And I asked, you know, our team, I was like, hey, it'd be really cool if we can make our theme song a cumbia. Because I felt like, well, one, I wanted it to be something that's more like a music of Latin America, something that you'd hear in the community. But I wanted it to be something that, like, as inclusive as possible. So I feel like almost every place in Latin America has cumbia, no matter.
That's for sure. That's been an awesome experience learning that.
Yeah. So half my family is from Ecuador, the other half's from Mexico. And the one thing that they share is they love cumbia because my family from Mexico is from DF. And,
yeah, sonideros, chicha, Peru. I mean, that's Peruvian chicha, it's the same thing.
Oh yeah, we like cumbia chicha.
But so, yeah. Y'all hit him up, and then How was that process? Were you like, hey, this is what we're thinking? Like, can you come up with the beat? Or, like, was it more, like, back and forth?
So, okay. So, we gave him a lot of control. So, basically, we like, listened to a bunch of cumbias.
Okay.
And we listened to some, like, different kinds. And we found ones that we liked, ones that were, like, slower, whatever, how that. And then we, like, sent him a bunch of different ones. And we're like, we like this vibe, we like that vibe, this is a good vibe we like. But also, we let him have a lot of control because he does have a background of being an urban planner. Mm. He went to school for that. He worked for that for many years. And people were, I think, probably before Chicano Batman took off. So I kind of didn't have to tell him to do very much because he already, in his head, he already knew the severity of what Jose Wisar did, and he could, I felt like, I mean, I'm not from Boyle Heights, but I felt like he really did get the vibe of like a Latinx neighborhood, but also it's a little bit unsettling, so, because of what, the corruption is unsettling, right? Mm-hmm. So I felt like, cause I didn't just want to have like a cumbia that's all happy and everything, right? So we had like this, we had a cool, and then the editors were like, okay, we wanted this vibe a little bit more, make it creepier, and yeah, I think we only need like 2 or 3 times the edits, and that's it.
Wow. I mean, it is a process. It's back and forth, but the fact that y'all were like, yeah, we're coming to you, and we're going to give you some ideas and then let you do your thing is, I think, what really hit it out of the park.
Thanks. Yeah, and I'm like, wow, I get to listen to a new track by him that he created for us. Wow.
That's awesome. And that's something I think I appreciate for you and your involvement in this process, right, that you are really, you know, putting yourself out there as the host, but then behind the scenes, as you were working on this too, you know, I can tell you were really out there just trying to like nudge things and influence things here and there in terms of like you just talked about the music and the artwork, también. Like, can you talk a little bit about the podcast artwork?
So artwork, okay, so the artwork that's coming out is from our own Tommy Gallegos. And it's really cool. He's making, like, a whole map. It's really fun. If you've seen his, like, artwork style, it's, like, a really fun style. And it's really, like, snarky, and I love it. So then, like, the cover artwork, we didn't have too much control over, but it's really cool, and I like it a lot. Yeah, it's, like, it's just funny. I think there's, like, I can't remember. I didn't see, like, some of the, like, I don't know which ones made it to the end, but there's like somewhere it's like Jose and he's like, oh, I forgot what it had, like, I don't know, it's like a sign, something for like the neighborhood for sale or whatever.
Oh, okay, caricature.
Yeah, and it's funny. And we had to get some things approved by the lawyers.
Of course. Still a show, it's still a production. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't want, I mean, just put slap allegedly right there.
Like, allegedly there. There's like one, oh my God, there's like one episode we had to retract everything because the lawyer's like, you had to add allegedly, but like to every other sentence.
Oh, man.
It sucked.
But yeah. That's good though. They caught y'all. They caught y'all before like it could go out there and like then it becomes even a bigger mess.
You know what? Yeah, we're expecting him to have a meltdown on Twitter. We're expecting him to get all mad.
Apparently, he's been resurfacing on social media.
Yeah, right when this thing starts to come out. He had like a meltdown. I mean, he had like a meltdown on, I think, Instagram.
Oh, where the last picture he posted of like a saint?
No. So he's been like commenting on other people's stuff. So one of our sources is Satoric.
Okay.
He's been commenting on all their stuff. Literally on the same day, our producer sent him a bunch of questions. He went on this rampage on, like, I think it was the same day of...
close enough.
Like, one of our sources. And he was, like, commenting on their stuff and, like... No, I don't want to say rampage. That's not correct. I should say he's just commenting on their stuff.
Being more vocal than before, for sure.
Yeah, so I'm expecting him to get mad. I'm expecting to get some... I'm a little anxious about it. I really do not want him to, like, give me an angry quote tweet or something. I'm not looking forward to it. I feel like it's going to happen. But you know what? Like, me as a person, I'm kind of scared. Like, me as Mariah, I'm anxious about it. But, like, me as a social media manager and me as, like, a marketer and me as, like, a content creator, I'm so ready for it and I want it to happen because it's going to be great for the engagement. And if he does that, like, it's the worst thing for him.
Just drag him.
LB sucks, because the last time, you know, last time he like commented at us at LA Taco, we made a whole podcast about it and we got to use it as content 3 years later.
Yeah.
And man. I did.
See, you know, Oh my God. Well, for your well being, I hope he doesn't. But at the same time, I know you're ready if he does, right?
Yeah, we're ready with our lawyers. Like, we're so ready. It's just going to be a headache.
You know, I mean, it always is. But that's why you got to cover, like, having a show like this being so well produced and having an amazing team behind you, despite, you know, the annoying things like that, like being, you know, right and having lawyers checked in, make sure, yeah, you got to have those books straight at the end of the day. So that way the work speaks for itself, right? Yeah. And the work y'all did and put into this, you know, is validated and folks can hear it. But I'm excited for folks to hear it. When will the show be available for folks?
The show will be available on Tuesday, October 26th. So probably by the time you hear this, it'll probably be already out.
Yeah.
But every Tuesday you can hear like a new episode. It's going to be good. Watch out for episode 8. That is my favorite episode. I mean, they're all great. They're all great. I love them all. But episode 8, I really love.
Episode 8. Okay, so that's pretty awesome that it's going to be episodic and not just one, like, big dump like we're used to in binging things. So with folks listening to the show, you know, you can subscribe. How can folks subscribe? I'm not sure.
Yeah, you just go on Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe there. If you can go to Spotify, you can follow us there.
Stitcher. Just look for The Sellout.
Look for Smokescreen, The Sellout.
Yeah. And of course, I'll have links to all of this in the episode description too.
Awesome, yeah.
So with folks, their immediate pending of listening to this series, once all 9 episodes are said and done and like folks have listened to the whole production, what is something you would like for them to leave with, aside from like all the stories y'all shared?
So I said this in the past at another show, but I want people to leave with, you cannot trust your elected officials. You cannot trust them. I don't want to say they're all bad. Not all of them are. I'm not trying to say that at all. Some could do some great things, right? But you can't just take them at face value. Like, especially if they're like, oh, I am one of you. I'm a part of this community. I'm going to stand up for you. Like, you know, it's okay to, like, not trust them. You got to just, you know, do your homework. Research, you know, watch them, see what they do, see how they vote on certain things. And I understand it's really hard. A lot of us are working a lot because we got that high rent that we just talked about. But there's a lot of great people here in LA. There's a lot of people doing the work for you. So all you got to do is check Twitter, check Instagram. So
this is true.
Yeah, there's a lot of city council watchdogs, you know, the People's City Council.
Just avoid the gadflies.
Just avoid the what?
The gadflies, all those folks that go to City Hall and, like, do all that problematic shit.
Oh, yeah. Avoid those people. However, there are people doing the work and people that, you know, you can tune into. You can see how they're voting. You can see what they're doing. Uh-huh. And, yeah, you can't take them at face value. However, when politicians, you know, mess up, are corrupt, it's not our fault. It's not on us. It's not because we don't, like, watch hard enough. Well, I mean, we could watch a little bit harder. But, you know, it's not, like... We can just be more involved. And also understanding that there's so much we can do beyond local government as people. We can look out for each other. We can help each other out. And we all have talents. We all have roles to play. And, yeah.
Perfectly said. I wholeheartedly agree that, yes, they are there. They have their role in this system that many of us are frustrated with and hate. But that's the system we got to work with. So hold them accountable. Hold their feet to the fire. And when they're not doing enough, if you feel up to it, yeah, like we talked about before, you can get together with folks from your community and start filling in those gaps where the politicians aren't. So shout out to all of y'all that actually do decide to do that or are already doing that, because I know it's not easy work.
Oh, yeah, no, it's laborious.
Yeah. So that pretty much wraps it up. You can find Mariah on Twitter at PapayaTheMariah. And I will have all of that stuff in the episode description. And yes, looking forward to hearing the rest of this show. Thank you again, Mariah, for coming through and talking about the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric. It's been so good.
Yeah. All right. That's it, everybody. This has been Orale Bojaitse. We'll catch you on the next one.